Welcome to It Shipped That Way, where we talk to product leaders about the lessons they've learned helping build great products and teams. I'm Alan Pike. Joining us today is Kate Huston. With a background in mobile engineering at Google and Automattic, Kate is now the engineering director of native apps at DuckDuckGo. Welcome, Kate.
Oh, hi, Alan. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here and making the time zone shenanigans necessary to do a cross-oceanic recording.
Yeah, it's a great way to spend a Friday night, hey?
Party time, talking about engineering leadership.
Exactly.
That's what I do for fun. So we're going to dig into a bunch of leadership management topics today. But first, I wanted to give you a chance to orient us, or especially the audience. I know about your background, but to tell a bit of the story, how do you like to describe your background? What's the Kate Huston story so far?
It's like so like normal engineering path, you know, like degree in computer science, dropped out of a master's program, went to work at Google, you know, ended up in management.
Just like that, snap.
Yeah, I mean, so actually somebody I know was like, oh, I'm looking for a manager for this team in Colombia. And I was like, oh, you know, I'll see if I know anybody. And then I came back and I was like, oh, did you find anybody? And he was like, oh, I haven't, if you would move to Colombia. And I was like, oh, of course I would move to Colombia. And that is how I ended up as a not entirely legal migrant in Colombia.
Okay, well, that is not just like that. You said totally normal story, just like everyone else. I just ended up moving to Colombia on the down low to get a leadership position.
Well, that's true. But like, I don't know, I was always like pretty, you know, like I grew up in the UK and then I went to Canada for grad school. Well, I went to Canada to learn to be a ski instructor and then I went to grad school in Canada and then I moved to Australia and then I was nomadic for like 4 years. Yeah, now I live in Ireland.
I love that tidbit about the origin story. So you've gone through this path. You've worked at Google. You're in a leadership position at Automattic, which is super cool and like increasingly cool. Not knowing too much about the business in the background, but obviously with all the tumult in social media right now, a lot of people are looking at Automattic like, oh, that's an interesting company. And then DuckDuckGo is also like a super interesting company. You know, I think a lot of people saw them as kind of like this hopeless underdog. Like, you can't take on Google. You can't build a search engine that people actually want to use. And then I feel like I talk to people more and more and more people, like it's my default. And I think talking to more and more people where that's the case for them too. So, and you're director of native apps there. What does that role look like? You know, what's the core of that role in your mind?
Yeah, it's basically to make sure that the native apps team can meet the needs of the organization, which have been growing significantly. So there's been a lot of scaling. There's been some processes that needed to be updated. I spent a lot of time on our like hiring processes, both on like hiring senior engineers and also like most recently director hiring. And then just a lot of like, it's like coaching people. So like just people management stuff. And then just like, you know, projects, right? Like, is this project going well? Could it be going better? Like, if I poke at it, will it improve it or will people just get mad at me? So, you know, like that kind of thing.
I feel like that's one of the fundamental questions of leadership is like, it will interfering in this make it better or worse?
Right. You're like Schrodinger's manager, like sometimes. But yeah, so I think a lot of the work I do tends to be like, I'm a very behind the scenes person, which I find really interesting because I'm like extremely online, you know, personally. And then at work, I'm like so behind the scenes. I don't, you know, not very few people know what I do.
Well, I imagine that's, well, I don't know. Is that an intentional strategy or is that just a personality thing coming through?
No, it's kind of weird. But yeah, I just like, I like to keep my like online persona like separate from my work persona because like, I don't know, I think everybody's worked with some internet thought leader who was actually an incompetent asshole. So I just, two halves of my life. So I just keep them separate. Yeah,
well, I think that's something that we all learn as you, if you're an online person, that you learn eventually meet some folks that have well, you know, outspoken online presences or personalities. Mm-hmm. And some of them are what this says on the tin and they have the, you know, genuine interests mm-hmm. and opinions that they express. And other times you interact with that person in real life and you're like, oh, actually, this is just a character you play on the internet.
Exactly.
You're just doing it for clicks.
You know, I remember somebody, I'm not going to say who it was, but they were talking about somebody who was really about like manager read me's and was writing all these posts about manager read me's, like, don't get me started on manager read me's. Anyway, my friend who had worked with this person was like, if only he did any of the things in that document.
I think everybody sort of collects some of those stories. We'll try not to get ourselves into too much trouble with that. But it is nice to try and walk the walk that we preach.
Mm-hmm.
You've already brought up a couple of the topics that I think would be good to dig into. And one of them is on hiring. And hiring is something where one of the fun and but also daunting things about leveling up as you go from individual contributor to manager to director of learning then to hire that next role, that level. And there's a lot of things that are in common, and then there's some things that are totally different. And you'd mentioned director hiring, which is a relatively new thing for me, but it's super fascinating. You know, how do you think about the differences and the similarities, but probably most interestingly, the differences in between hiring somebody at this sort of director level, talent-wise, as opposed to kind of more individual contributor or maybe line manager roles?
I think when you're hiring like an IC or maybe even a line manager, like you have something that you know how to do and you're looking for somebody who can do that. And when you hire a director, you have something that you don't know how to do and you're trying to hire somebody who can do that.
That is a really great way of summarizing, or at least the experiences that I've had attempting to do this and the difficulty curve, I guess. I suppose it's possible that you could be hiring, and certainly there's some circumstances where, you know, there's a VP who was the director of X and they're just trying to replace themselves. But certainly I've been in the position, it sounds like you have been in too, where it's like, okay, I really know how to do this thing, but I need a director to take this piece of it that, you know, our needs are exceeding my capabilities, or that we just have never had, don't have any experience at X. How does that change how you approach the problem, and what are the pitfalls or mistakes that you maybe have seen happen with that change in mindset?
I guess like the first thing is, I think it's a mistake to think that you know how to do the job of someone you're hiring into a leadership position. Because especially if you have a bunch of tenure, you have a bunch of organizational context, you know, the things that you do like don't necessarily apply to the person you're hiring, you know? Like, I love my boss. We have a great relationship, but like sometimes he's like, I would do this. And I'm like, great, white male CTO. What am I going to do? Because this doesn't necessarily apply. In terms of like approaching it generally, like I think that for me is really important, because you have to try and understand somebody's strengths and how I think the best way to do that is to look at their previous experience. So at DuckDuckGo, we do a lot of work sample projects, especially for ICs. Or like, you know, here's this project and it's very similar to the kind of like core problem that we work on day to day. And then we evaluate it. But giving like a director some kind of hypothetical thing or like some kind of toy problem, like that wouldn't provide any kind of useful signal at all, right? I want to know how they operate in a complex situation. And I also want to know not just like what they do, but why they do it. Like, I think often people from large organizations will like tell you how they navigate a large bureaucracy, but why is that? Like, why do they do it that way? Is it like that's how you're effective in the large bureaucracy? Or do they have some like principles that they're operating from that they apply in this large bureaucracy? So DuckDuckGo, I think the principles are particularly important when it's like a smaller company that operates in like, frankly, a pretty weird way, because unless people have a depth of understanding, they can't adapt their playbooks.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense and really is interesting to me, because I'm particularly fascinated with companies that are weird, because almost always there's something to learn there. Like if you're just like, oh, we just use the standard playbook. So could you tell me a little bit about like what makes DuckDuckGo weird, you know, other than like it's a search engine trying to compete with Google and it's called DuckDuckGo, which are cool and weird things, but as an organization.
Actually describe ourselves as a privacy company, but I'm just going to leave that topic for somebody else. But as a director, right, like I think one of the things that's weird about DuckDuckGo is that you don't just get given like, this is your director, right? You can imagine you get hired at some bigger companies like, oh, you're a director. Here is your 100-person team. Here is your admin assistant. Go. And a DuckDuckGo is much more like you have to build your own directorate, right? And so I've been hiring directors into my team because it just got too big for me. And it's basically like, here's this problem space there is a director level role here, but you're going to need to like figure out what that looks like and build it in terms of like the different things that we have. So instead of like managers, we have this concept of career advisory, which like, honestly, I think is really just the definition of managing a high performer. But, you know, there's a little bit more like latitude in it, right? So you don't just get given like, here are your people, you manage them now. Like they have to want you to be their career advisor.
Oh, interesting. So like this is sort of that inverse, like that hints a little bit of holacracy, which I assume it's not in most ways, but like there's a little bit of this, someone opts into like, there's a little bit of, there's more agency, it sounds like.
Yeah, there's a lot of agency. And then, you know, we have like functional team leads. We have, so it's like a regular like platform team, for example. And then we have what we call objectives, which are really like product teams. So they're normally run by a product manager. And so there are places there where like this product manager clearly needs an engineering partner. Like, go and figure out what that means with this person so that you can deliver on this like complex work stream together.
Okay. So just to make sure I understand, you're saying that basically people don't have a manager unless they choose to have a manager. And if so, they choose a particular one? Or are you saying like people have a manager and then they also have like a career advisor as well? Or like, tell me a little more about the mechanics of that.
So they have a career advisor that they agree to. So when people join, it's like, this is your career advisor.
Okay.
But like, especially over time, they get like a level of choice in that.
Okay. So everyone has one and only one, or at least one.
Only one.
Only one.
Yeah.
And I'm keeping an open mind here. Who knows, right? And so they have one career advisor, but then when as a role evolves and they're growing and maybe the scope or attention changes or needs, then they're part of that conversation about who should be your career advisor. And then do you have like a hierarchical org chart of like, these are the career advisors for these career advisors and it's a chain? Or is it possible that like your career advisor is being then career advised by somebody who isn't even related to the same path? Like it's not like a tree structure.
I think in practice, most things are trees and it's pretty normal. Like my team is, it's like a tree except for one person,
okay.
You know, and like my career advisor is the CTO. So like we're in a pretty like normal tree, but I think the point is that it doesn't have to be a normal tree, right? And even within that, it's not necessarily, you know, so I have Android developers who are career advising Windows developers, for example. Mm. And I think the good thing about it is that when you're in, let's say a normal organization, your manager is your manager and you get what you get. You don't like your manager, you have to change your job as well. So you have to go work on something else, or you have to go work somewhere else. But in this structure, sometimes, you know, we allocate people based on our like best information when they join. And sometimes like 3 to 6 months later, I look at the situation, I talk to the career advisor and I'm like, this isn't actually what's best for this person. You know, I thought this person needed a really like low-key supportive career advisor, but actually they need someone who is going to be a little bit more like authoritarian and hard driving with them. Sounds really bad, but like some people actually really want, you know?
Certainly I've seen that dynamic. Like, you know, not, you sort of imply something bad about that person, but it isn't at all. It's like where they are at the stage of what they need. And I've seen incredible things happen where somebody who didn't really have a lot of motivation and purpose, given somebody who has a little bit more structure and is a little bit more firm with their communication and things like that, and then they flourish. So I totally get that.
Yeah, it's a better way to put it. And sometimes it's like the model that that person needs, right? Like if they're a bit more low-key, they're maybe not pushing back as much as they like could or should be. And so when they have a career advisor who's a bit more assertive, so then they can like teach them how to be a bit more assertive in that way too. And so it's almost like, you know, does somebody need the career advisor that's like simpatico, or do they need the career advisor that challenges them? And you make your guess as people come in, but sometimes, you know, you're wrong and then you can change it without changing like really anything about that person's job.
It doesn't sound like then that's, or I don't know, or I assume that you're not just having that and totally as like the individual contributor realizes like, I think I could use somebody who's a little bit more firm and assertive with me. It sounds like there's two different things going on, that maybe when people are more junior or maybe starting out in the organization, you have a little bit more top down, like, hey, I think this is what these people need. And then maybe when people are getting to the higher levels in the organization or further along in their career, that they're more involved in that conversation.
Yeah, well, we only hire senior plus people, but like basically people get what we think is best when they join. And then at some point you might have a conversation with them, which is like, is this or they might have that conversation with their career advisor of like, is this what's serving you? Like, what do you need right now? What would you benefit from? I think the reality I find is that like people really like their career advisor and they don't initiate a switch. But like sometimes, you know, like one thing I'll do is I'll just like come in and be like, look, I'm not going to make you do anything. I'm just going to make you think about it.
I get that. Every time I hear one of these kind of management or leadership or structural dynamics, my brain just starts going 100 directions. Like, oh, what are all the interesting consequences that could be? Like, oh, like how did that? What did that affect? Like the total jerk manager, and then everyone wanting to leave their team. Like, obviously, would get outed faster, which is a nice thing when you involve people in conversations about their manager. But one of the things that it makes me think of is this conversation that you and I have had a little bit, and I know you've written about, which is this idea of like the servant leadership, which obviously is kind of like aligned in some ways of what you're describing, which is like, oh, managers should be incentivized to want their team members to stay on their team, or we're not talking about teams, but like the career advisor, right? And that people could maybe leave this, so then that creates some incentives even more to like want to try to make sure that you're supporting that person and all these sort of things. But you've written what to me is really insightful things as someone who loves the idea of servant leadership. Like, yeah, we're here to support the people. They're not here for us. We're here for them, for the people who report to us. But then you've written some things about kind of some of the pitfalls with that, maybe educated a little bit by some of the dynamics you've seen at DuckDuckGo. Do you want to tell us a little bit how you coach people to think about that dynamic in between, like, you know, serving your team, but not like serving them?
Yeah. Like the core thing for me and the idea of servant leadership is like, you can't be the servant of people that you have power over. So either you're pretending you don't have that power or you've given it away.
Right. Hence making it harder to actually be effective as a leader.
Exactly. Exactly. So both of those are pitfalls, right? Like you've given away your power, like you can no longer do your job. And if you're pretending you don't have it, you're really just gaslighting people. You'll be like, oh yeah, buddy. But at some point it's review time or it's something, you're going to have to do something. And then the truth will come out.
Right.
Power dynamics are like a whole topic in and of themselves. But like, it is your job as a manager to make your team effective. It's not your job as a manager to make them happy. They're adults. They're responsible for their own happiness. Which doesn't mean you should torture them, you know, in the management style
of Elon
Musk that we're all seeing right now, right? Like, but also because that does not make your team effective, you know?
Yeah.
Maybe you can torment people into shipping something this week, but like you can't torment them into staying and working with you long term, right?
Effectiveness requires retention. They must be here to be effective.
Well, otherwise you're going to spend a lot of time hiring. Like you're going to be less effective. Your churn is going to be really high. And then, you know, similarly, like managers who like prioritize their team's happiness over everything else, like there are no amount of like treats and kudos that is going to make a team that is not shipping happy.
I've seen that. Do you think the idea of servant leadership is like inherently flawed, or do you think it's more that you just have to make sure like that it does make sense to try to keep the mental model of that you're there to support the team rather than the other way around, but that you need to be cognizant of the power dynamic and make sure that you're prioritizing supporting their effectiveness rather than supporting their subjective happiness or what you project maybe their happiness will be today based on, you know, they don't want to fix this annoying bug or something.
I think that the name, like, I think there's some useful, like, if you read about servant leadership, you might read something that's really good, or you might read something that's utter nonsense, because the name itself is just, like, problematic because of this power thing. So it's like, you know, what do you mean by servant leadership? Do you mean that, you know, it's your job to kind of help the team be effective? Do you mean that it's not, you're not, like, seeking out recognition as a leader? Stuff like that. Like, those are all, like, reasonable things, but you could call them what they are, you know, and not put them into this bucket, right? Because just like the name is just like this big catch-all that people can use to mean like really terrible things. They say, you know, let's go back to some manager read meetings, right? Like I remember reading one and this guy's like, I practice servant leadership, blah, 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 blah. Buried down in it, right, is this comment of like, we will have a 30-minute one-on-one every 2 weeks. If you do not put an agenda there, then the one-on-one is cancelled. I'm like, it's a reasonable thing to do, but like, it doesn't actually send the message of like,
different vibe.
No, I work for you, yeah. Right? It's like, you just saying you're a servant leader because you think it sounds nice. Like you sound like kind of a despot if I read the rest of your document. And like, that's fine. maybe this guy has a job where he needs to be kind of a despot, but like maybe he's just admit that instead of being like pretending.
Manager, read me. I'm a despot. I'm.
But I remember giving this like manager some feedback once, or like team lead some feedback, and I was like, you know, you're being like pretty authoritarian, basically, with the team and like whatever. Anyway, what they said back to me was they were like, I practice servant leadership, and I was just like, oh, that's me told.
You're being authoritarianly told not to call them authoritarian.
exactly. I'm like, it's like, well, you know, like I must be wrong because you're practicing this thing that is fundamentally meaningless. Like, okay, I guess my feedback's useless then. You do you.
Sorry, I wasn't rude because in fact, I'm nice. So please stop talking. Oh, okay, great. Thanks. Okay, good to know.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Exactly.
Okay, I love that. I'm gonna kind of turn on that a bit in my background. One of the other things I wanted to get kind of a bit of a read for you, or get a chance to talk about a little, is the idea of, and it probably factors well in actually to the things that we've talked about here, how we measure success. You know, obviously giant companies, you know, larger than yours or mine, get more and more lured to the idea of metrics of like, okay, what is the team velocity? What is this group's velocity? How fast are we moving? And we're seeing a lot of drama in the press about companies that are doing sort of dramatic and maybe questionable things on the idea of like, we got to move faster, I need higher velocity. How do you think about measuring or even just talking about the effectiveness and pace of work on teams? Is it something that is even worth trying to measure or think about, or we just sort of trust the team that like if they're all focused that we're just going to assume the pace that they're working is the right pace, or how do you think about that?
I think if you ask anybody how their team is doing, they're going to tell you that their team is actually good. But it's much easier to measure progress than state.
It's much easier to measure progress than state. Yeah, absolutely.
So you can tell if a team is improving, right? But you can't really tell if a team is good. So I'm just like, what if we just didn't know if any of our teams were good? And we just focused on like knowing if they were improving or not. And at some point they'll be good. We won't know when.
Mm-hmm. All right, I'm picking up what you're putting down. So rather than trying to measure velocity, you're trying to measure change in velocity, which I think is called jerk. Or no, acceleration. You're trying to measure acceleration. So that's your kind of like mental model. Is that like an accurate kind of description of your mental model of it?
Yeah, because I think when you start talking like, oh, is the team doing well? You're just like having the wrong conversation, right? Because everyone will get like defensive and justifying of it, you know? And instead, I just like to talk about like, how can the team do better? How has the team improved? Like, those are the celebrations, right? Not the like, you know, I'm sure you've seen those teams that are like really... From the outside, it's like this team does not seem to be doing that well, but they're talking about how great they are and patting themselves on the back all the time, you know? Like, that's why I hate that conversation, because all the metrics can be gained and say, like, story points is our metric. Like, okay, every story is worth double the points. Now the team's doing twice as well. Like, you know.
Yay, we won. We made lots of points
go
up.
Good job.
The graph is going. How do you think then, or I don't know, maybe there's no such thing as this, but like, how do you think about teams that are sort of at peak performance, or it's like, there's no such thing. Like there's no team where it's like, they're doing well enough that our focus is to try and, or a good focus is to try and help them continue to execute that way. Or is it really just like, if you're not improving, you're dying. Therefore, you know, there isn't really a concept, or it's not worth trying to think about. These are the teams that are being most effective. Let's try to be more like them and maybe less like these other teams.
I think the most effective teams do this. Like, they're always looking at how they can be doing better and what would be helping them and what's slowing them down.
I think that accurately describes the best teams I've ever worked with. Wait, you just said that the best teams I've worked with are the ones that don't think they're the best. The ones that are worrying about how to be better, and the ones that think they're the best teams are average or less.
Exactly. Because they're focused on what can be better, not on like saying that everything is fine, right? It's a different mindset.
Do you think that there's things we can do as managers, or directors, leaders in an org to help foster that mindset of growth and acceleration and improvement, rather than a mindset of trying to benchmark, okay, well, what's the velocity of this team or what's the velocity of this product? And, Are these people being too slow or that kind of thing?
Yeah, the thing I like to use though is the idea of experiments fade, because like I don't want to be the person on the team's tail every week being like, how can you be better? How can you be better? Mm-hmm. Just going to piss everyone off, right? So I'm just like, how do you think you can be better? What could we try? And so, you know, and I think often people are afraid to suggest things in case it's wrong. And so I like to talk about experiments. You know, like, what experiments are we going to try to see if this will be better? Like, let's experiment with a release train. Let's experiment with a daily text-based stand-up. Let's experiment with the things that we think might improve things and see if they actually work.
Yeah, I love that, because there's a dynamic that I imagine you've probably seen too, that I see where we have whatever process, retros or debriefs or whatever it is their your habit that your team is looking back on some time period and saying, okay, what are the things that went well? What are the things that could be do better? And one of the things that tends to burn people out on some teams with those retros is that there's certain types of problems that kind of feel like, at least to leadership or some of the senior people on the team, feel like it's just part of software. Like, oh, people don't respond to my pull request immediately, right? It takes a non-zero amount of time for my PRs to get reviewed, right? And so then people are like, oh, I think it should be even faster. And you'll start to get, like, stereotypically, the more senior people on the team will be like, you know, it's just kind of a thing. It takes a non-zero amount of time for people to review pull requests. Like, you should probably just stop complaining about it, please, you know? And so then someone's bringing something up in a retro as like a thing that they think could be better. And there's other people who are saying, I don't think it can be better, or it's not worth trying to make better. And then that discourages them from giving feedback. And so I love that mental model that you have there of experiments as it's like, okay, well, yeah, you know, maybe we might not be able to make it better, but like, maybe we can. And it seems to me like giving that person or the org a chance to have more experiments to try to make it better and then see if it fails or not would give people a little more satisfaction than just a senior person saying like one day to review a pull request is pretty good. Like, please stop complaining.
Totally. But the other thing I like to foster along with that is like, get people to agree on the problem. Because like the number one complaint from engineers trying to do any kind of process change is like, I proposed this thing and people told me no. And I'm like, the solution is not interesting. You get people to agree on the problem, then the solution will be obvious or boring, or someone will come up with something that you haven't even thought of. But like the point where people are at, like when somebody in that situation is at, it's like they see some kind of problem on the team, they think it could be better, and they propose a solution. And then an argument starts about the solution. And then they come back and they're like, oh, why won't people do this thing? It's such a good idea. And I'm like, because you had the wrong conversation. These people have not noticed this problem that you've noticed. So until you get them on the same page with that, like you're just going to, your arguments are pointless.
And then if you get them on the same page, then a totally different solution comes out, or maybe the same solution, but if a totally different solution comes out, then awesome. Assuming you really are actually caring about this underlying problem and you don't just have a hobby horse that you wish we could be riding go.
Exactly. Totally. And then, you know, I think it's like, you know, the value that you're providing is really not like the solution that you're proposing. Like, I don't care. Nobody cares. What we care about is that this problem is now better than it was before. And like, so it doesn't matter if you propose the solution or you take somebody else's solution or some kind of mixture of the both. The fact that you took the problem and drove it through to resolution, like that's what's valuable.
How do you think then of this common advice that you'll hear, which people will say, oh, when you're talking to a manager or a group or whatever, don't come with problems, come with solutions, right? Like, don't just come to me and say, oh, our pull requests are too slow. Come in and say, well, how about we consider this or whatever? Do you think that that's like flawed advice, or is it just incomplete advice?
I think it's terrible, but like people try to do this to me sometimes. They come to me with some kind of solution and I'm like, why do you think this is a good idea? Like, I didn't all the way back to the beginning, they have to explain all of it. But yeah, I think, you know, if you're somebody in a leadership position saying that, like, then you're only going to hear about the problems that people think they can solve.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. And I've seen that dynamic before. Do you think that there is value, though, in this mental model that some organizations try to promote, which is encouraging this sort of bottom-up thinking where people come, you know, ideally, people flagging problems, even if they don't know the solution. The building's literally on fire. It's like, okay, well, what are you going to do about it, man? You know, like, ideally, people are posing or bringing up problems, even if they don't have a solution, but that also in trying to encourage people to feel comfortable to make proposals and practice that loop rather than falling into, or I don't know, maybe there certainly are merits to the top-down sort of come to us with problems and then leadership will help you find solutions. But like, do you think there is merit to try to build a culture where the solutions are also coming from the bottom up and we're teaching people at lower and lower levels of the org to be able to think about the whole problem to solution chain?
Yeah, I just see the like solution and the empowerment as distinct things. Like you come with a problem, you come with a solution, but you're not empowered to implement that solution. Like that wasn't, what have you done? You know, like most problems in engineering have a pretty standard set of solutions that we deploy. Similarly, just because somebody comes with a problem doesn't mean that they don't feel empowered to develop the solution. And this is where you can coach people into increasing their impact by like helping them think through it. So like, honestly, if somebody has a solution, that's fine. I'm not saying you could never come to me with a solution. I'm just saying you better have a problem for your solution. And I would want to hear about it. And, you know, that then like my job is to like empower that person to kind of get other people bought into that problem and to have team buy into like whatever solution emerges.
Yeah.
But I do think part of what drives that thinking is that people don't want to listen to complaints.
It's not as fun as some of the other things you could be doing.
I'm natively British, so it's complaining like a national pastime. So like, I just have no problem with people complaining to me. I'm like what am I, sometimes the question I ask in one-on-ones is, I was like, if I made you complain about one thing, what would it be?
Yeah, it can be hard. I mean, for Canadian, as our team is right. Mostly Canadian. And so getting people to complain about things like, come on, you got it. There has to be, they say you're not supposed to force people to give you critical feedback, but it's just like, come on, like you got to give me, you have to criticize something. It's like, well, maybe occasionally, sometimes every once in a while, you talk a little bit more in a meeting than maybe you really have to, but it's okay. Cause you know, I'm like, okay, all right. I've like extracted this under great duress.
Exactly. I think the thing about like complaint, like people who will complain to you, whether you have to make them complain to you or like they come and complain, like solutionizing is a form of complaining. It's just a polite form of complaining that's acceptable in Canada, right? Like someone's come up with some kind of solution because they think something could be better. Like that is great energy to harness towards improvement. And the kind of complaining that I really don't like is like when people complain to like tear things down. You know, So it's like you can complain because something's out of your control, or you can complain because you want it to be better, but you're not totally sure how. Those are great. But like toxic people just complain to make things worse.
Yeah. Like they just want to see the world burn.
Right. Exactly. Or they believe the world is already burning and that everything would be better if everybody agreed with them. You know,
don't you understand? Nothing can ever be good. Software is always terrible. No process will ever help anything. We should just all stop trying. Why don't you all understand?
Exactly.
Speaking of everything is burning, one last thing I wanted to run by you. Because we have a shared background leading mobile app teams. And so I'm legally obligated to ask you about cross-platform technologies. Because this is the thing that everybody wants to talk to me about. Native development, React Native, and how the different technologies compare. So like you, I know you specialize on the native side. Most of the work that I've done on the native side is on the native side as well, even though we've done a bunch of cross-platform stuff. Mm-hmm. How do you think about the opportunity of cross-platform technologies or potentially the menace of cross-platform technologies, depending on your mindset?
I just have to find it really hilarious when people bring that topic to me now. I'm like, oh, you think we can build a web browser in React Native? Like, what? Like, no. Like, that one can't be done. Yeah, so I guess let's talk about, like, DuckDuckGo specifically and then more broadly. So, like, we work in this problem space where we build these privacy-preserving browsers. And one of the core decisions that we've made is we use the WebView component that's available on the platform, right? And this is, in fact, completely distinct on each of the platforms. There's, like, even, I think, between macOS and iOS, it's not, like, technically the same, but I think it's close enough that we managed to share a lot of code. But like Android versus iOS, totally different. And so that means that we have two places where we can share code. So we can share code at the very top of the stack. So we can inject in JavaScript and we can share code at the very bottom of the stack. So we can have something that's like in C++ with no dependencies. But anything in the middle is actually just really hard to share because the WebView component works differently. And actually, the complexity is not really in the code. It's in the problem, the testing, the edge cases, the breakage, and all the rest of it. I mean, which I think to take more broadly is like sharing code works where the value compared to the overhead is worth it.
Yeah, I mean, that's the fundamental discussion and debate that I think that happens on every, you know, it's especially difficult on medium-sized teams, like really small teams. Often it's like obvious they either just, they mm-hmm. love the technology they already know, or they're so small that there's only one approach that could work. And then really, really large teams, often they have the budget that's like, well, you know, we can go native and it has a bunch of advantages for our problem space. Or maybe it's obvious to them, maybe they're large enough, like, oh, we're going to just build our own custom cross-platform framework or whatever it is. If you have 100,000 people in your company, you can just kind of do whatever you want. But in the medium-sized teams, often you have the debate about exactly what you said. What is the point where the trade-off is worth it? And there's a bunch of factors that go into that. I mean, I find your argument about why for DuckDuckGo it's not very compelling. I find that compelling, right? Like, I'm a little biased towards that. I do often, like the native solutions for things. I think it's an interesting thing to build in our minds as people who do sometimes need to think about these tools. Is like, what are the trade-offs and the times where any given tool, whether it's cross-platform tools or something else, gives us a big win to help us understand, are we in that state? As opposed to the thing that a lot of people want to have the conversation is like, no, but what's the right way to build all apps? is everything going to, is native going to die and everything's going to become cross-platform? Is cross-platform going to crash and burn and everything's going to become native again? Like what's going to win? I don't know. I find the idea of those trade-offs or when are the big wins for one or the other a lot more interesting.
No, I totally agree with you. I don't think either's going to win or die, right? Like, it's just like, it depends, to your point, exactly on your circumstance. We actually put React Native in the WordPress apps.
Okay, yeah.
And this was like a huge argument for a long time. And I remember somebody was like, oh, if you have React Native and this menu changes, then you don't need to like rebuild it. And I'm like, we don't need to rebuild it if it's like the menu's configured on the server and we download it. Like, building a table view is just really not the big problem that we're having, you know, or the ordering of that table view, especially, is not the big problem we're having. But when it came to the like new block-based editor, then the decision became more worth it because the complexity was so high, but the cost was also huge. And I think this is like one of the things that drives native teams nuts from web developers, is they're like, it's like they think the component was the work.
Right.
But actually getting that component in and working and the overhead of having it on your build system and all the rest of it, like, that's a lot of work. Building a table view or a list view on Android, like, this is just not hard. It is not hard. You don't like gain anything by like importing your table view from React Native, adding 10 minutes to your build time every time, and then dealing with a breakage every month. Like, that is like a net loss.
I've heard people pitch using React Native just for a setting screen because they're like, well, it's not going to be as polished, but then it's the same across both platforms. And then, you know, when we add an item to this table view, then, you know, we won't have to do it on both and they'll be consistent. And it's like, what a huge sledgehammer to fix the easiest problem in your entire project.
Exactly. But like, we have some shared C++ code, for example, and it's like a Bloom filter. That thing is like, the code is very stable, but it's very complicated. You don't want to deal with it going wrong. And like, the overhead that it adds to the build is totally worth it. The JavaScript stuff, I think, and I mean, this is one of the things that becomes like the chicken and the egg, right? Is like, you know, we add a bit of JavaScript, adds a bunch of hassle, and we're like, oh, did we really get anything yet? And so it wasn't until we'd added quite a bit of it that's like, okay, finally, we're like actually getting enough value from this. But like, the ongoing cost of handling it is like much higher than I think the people who like push for these like cross-platform or like hybrid solutions tend to acknowledge.
I heard on the internet that it's half the cost if it's cross-platform because you don't have to write it twice. It's just half, right? Isn't it just that simple?
Exactly. But then, you know, the other thing is like, when it breaks, you end up debugging at one level of indirection.
No, right? You're not supposed to talk about that. It's half the cost. You just read it once and then it just works. Bugs only happen on one platform. I have loved this conversation. I feel like we could probably talk for another hour. So I want to really thank you for making the time. How do people find out more about your work and how do people find you on the internet?
Kate.blog.
Kate.blog. That's Kate with a C and a wonderful domain name. Thanks for making the time. It Shipped That Way is brought to you by Steamblock Software. If you're a growing business and your customers need a really nice mobile app, get in touch with Steamclock. And that's it for today. You can give us feedback or rate the show by going to itshipped.fm or at itshipped.fm on Twitter, if Twitter still exists when this episode comes out. Until next time, keep shipping.